My name is Fawn, and I'm a recovered alcoholic, a grateful member of the Lakewood Park Group. My sobriety date is October 25th, 1974. And the only reason I know that's the truth is because my son is 45, and I had him just shortly after I got sober. So otherwise, I would probably even doubt it. It seems like a very big number. I'm so grateful tonight to be here with you all. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the support, and thank you for the opportunity to be of service. I love our literature, right? And I remember walking into one of my first meetings, and there was a rack of literature right next to the coffee pot. And because I resisted making eye contact with people early on and was really shy, I picked up a piece of literature. May have been Is AA for You, 44 Questions. But the one that, two that were my favorite, one was Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. And the other was A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic. They discontinued that pamphlet in 1978, I think. But I loved that pamphlet. I read it, I reread it, I carried it in my pocketbook. If I was on the train, I would open it up because I felt it was speaking directly to me. It was age, I was 21 when I got sober, so it didn't really speak to a specific age of a person, but it spoke to feelings, and I loved that. Tonight, we're going to be sharing on this pamphlet, and I'm going to screen share just because it'll help me get. So this is the pamphlet that we're going to be using tonight is called Do You Think You're Different? It's pamphlet P13. So to the forward of the fourth edition of the big book, it says literature has played a major role in AA's growth. Later on, it says, and while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices within the fellowship. So I think the literature is the piece that carries. This is what people read, and they say, this is what AA is. Beyond what happens in the meeting, because if you go from an area or even from one group to another, groups can be very different. I found that true when I got sober in Brooklyn, New York in 1974, and I visited New England. And boy, I'll tell you, those Yankees all did things all wrong. You know, their meetings were longer, and they had raffles. This wasn't right. But I had been schooled and enough to know that they had a right to do things their own way. But I just, and then later, many years later, I moved to Florida, and for sure I was in for a shock there because it was completely different. But I had become more open-minded, and it only took me, I'm going to say 3 years to settle in to the way Florida did it. In the foreword to the third edition of our big book, it says, the basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals with many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of, it should be many different nationalities. And on page 17 of the big book, it has that familiar quote, we are not people who normally, we are not people who would normally, so I messed that all up. We are people who normally would not mix. Let's see if we can. Thank you. So the pamphlet was originally printed as So You Think You're Different. And being a service junkie, I like to think of myself, I pulled out my advisory actions and I said, wait, let's see what the literature committee had to say about this, because all our advisory actions are published in a combined format. So it was pretty easy because I have the most recent one. So I went back and I looked at what had happened with this pamphlet. So in 1977, Advisory Action changed the title and replaced a story. They recommended removal of the story of Maria, a Spanish-speaking woman, and replaced it with Jan, an agnostic. There are additional items that were discussed over the years that did not result in changes. For example, there was talk about language barriers and sexual preferences in 1977, 78, and 84. There are 13 short stories in this pamphlet with an encouraging introduction and ending. Of these 13 stories, 7 had appeared in Grapevine articles. I found 2 of them. One was Lewis's story. He was 79 when he got sober. And his story is pretty interesting. This appeared in the September 1961 issue. The second one was George's story on page 22. This was an article entitled My Son, the Alcoholic, that appeared in the April 1967 issue. This may be a little small for you to see these stories. The first one is Gloria, an alcoholic African-American woman. She says, after coming into AA and recognizing that she was among a minority, but she said, well, where else was I to go? And then towards the end of her story in this little pamphlet, she says, there's something about the AA that goes right through all the differences I worried about. Ed, an alcoholic atheist, said, I don't want to change AA. It works for me. I just want it to be effective in attracting rationalists. Their memberships will help AA tremendously. Paul, an alcoholic Native American, said, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce looked upon his people and saw them cold, destitute, homeless, lonely, and defeated. He said, we can't go on living the life we once knew. We must begin a new life. Take the best the white man has to offer and the best the red man has to offer and begin this new life. Diane, a 15-year-old alcoholic, wrote, sex also became very important because I wanted love, lots of love. And later wrote, I came in contact with AA. I liked the love I got. I needed that love. I stayed in drunk, wanting to be a part of, not apart from. She ended up getting sober. And George is an alcoholic who is Jewish. He wrote, when I was in the sauce, I wasn't a Jew. I wasn't an American. I wasn't a man. I was just a drunk, loveless and unloving, respectful of no one and nothing, least of all, myself. So I read these stories and I identify with each of them, not because of their particular things, but there were things that rang true to me. I came in, as I said, when I was 21. I thought that was really young. I was just legal. I won't say I came in at legal age of drinking, because in New York, the legal age of drinking was 18. So I've been legally drinking for a few years. But I was still young, and I really thought that my life was over. But the truth was, I felt that my life was over. I felt that if I had to resign myself to church basements with old men, smoke-filled, and drinking coffee, at least I'd have a chance at life. I wasn't fighting it anymore. I was resolved to being there. So it wasn't about age. And people, of course, you know, some of the old timers had to make that silly remark, I spilled more than you drank, right? And if you were young, you may have still heard that said to you. It's the most ridiculous thing. And I'd say, well, how old do you have to die? Right? Because I didn't think I really had much time left. My body was really pretty much a mess by that point. I I grew up in a mixed home. My mother's Native American, and my father is combined Anglican, mostly Irish family. And even the Native American pamphlet used to give me a headache. I tried reading it, and I just couldn't. But I liked the story that was in here. I thought it was a lot more gently written than the whole pamphlet on Native American. There are today many, many pamphlets that supplement what's in this and go into more detail. But I wasn't here because of my differences. I was grateful to find a commonality. And later, through work in the steps, I came to believe that I was able to step out of that world of my uniqueness into being just a human being. And that came about the first time I did my written fourth step. And as I told my story to my sponsor, I do my steps pretty much the same way today as I did it then. I wasn't one of these who had a good grasp of where I was prior to getting sober. I wasn't really much of anything before I got sober. I didn't identify with you, and I really didn't know my place. I found a job that allowed me to function and be useful to some degree, and it didn't require a whole lot of investment of energies in or creativity, and didn't demand a whole lot of me. And that was fine, because my goal was to have whatever it took for me to have my seat at Charlie's at the end of the day. And to be able to, the great privilege of running a bar tab, that was my goal. And so when I got sober, I had that, and but it wasn't fulfilling, right? These other stories in here, you know, they come around to, like, I love the one where he goes through and he talks about all the things that they used to drink, right? And the drinking Sterno and aftershave and mouthwash. Now, when I got sober, I did hear these things. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion about substances other than alcohol when I got sober. I am solely an alcoholic. I am not an ANDA, although it doesn't mean that I don't have ANDA issues. But I don't. I'm an alcoholic. But I don't conform myself into thinking that I can play games with anything else. I already had done that before I got sober. So each one of these people, as I go on in my journey in recovery, I relate to the feelings that they shared, not the differences. And I appreciate that there was a pamphlet that said this, "Do you think you're different?" in the book, in the little pamphlet, wire pamphlet holders, right? Because it's something I could pick up and read and go, "Oh, there is, oh, really? You mean a clergyman can get sober? Really?" And then shortly after that, I met both a nun and a priest who were, and I've known several clergy, people again, the language changed. This woman, she identified herself as a lesbian. And in her story, she goes, "I'm a homosexual." So those kind of conversations, you can tell that those might be a little dated. But it still speaks to her feeling of uniqueness. But over time, again, it isn't what makes me unique. It's what makes me the same. In a meeting, I sit in a meeting. And I listen to a speaker. I like speaker meetings. I like discussion meetings. But I often like this. If I'm in a meeting, I want to identify. I don't want to compare. So this is it. When I'm identifying, my head is going up and down. And when I'm comparing, I'm going left to right. No, that wasn't me. No, I never did that. I learned when I'm doing no left to right, there needs to be a big yet on the top of my head. Maybe I didn't do that yet. You know, I wasn't arrested. Came close. In fact, I almost got my dog shot by a very friendly police officer. I had a very big dog at one point in my drinking. he left me to go to better places. He had enough of that, this little drunk, right? But and being threatened by a police officer really probably wasn't in his dream category either. But I hadn't been arrested. I hadn't been detoxed, only because there really weren't detoxes when I got sober. Not in the sense that we talk about them today. There were always the spin dries that would get you off the street, and they didn't really offer much in the way of any medical or treatment program. They were really what we call like spin dries, where you go in just to get really to get off the street, get a meal in you. I hadn't had a DUI, only because when it was talked about, I lived in New York, I didn't need a car. And I said to myself, why would I want, I know I'll just get in trouble if I have a license and a car. I knew that. I knew things about me. I knew that while I had this amazing scholarship to State University in New York, I couldn't go because I said, I'll just go and get drunk. There's no point in me going there. I could do that here. Why waste everybody's time? So over time, this feeling of being, you know, the differences, right? Occasionally it comes up, like it can be a little thought provoking to sit in a meeting with people and say, I have, you know, just over 47 years of sobriety. It does kind of can make people look at me as if I'm a little different. The question comes, well, why do you still go to meetings? Well, because I know that I have a disease that wants me dead, that is progressive, incurable, and fatal. And that I've, from my experience, I've seen the greatest success here in these rooms. I also continue to try to identify, not compare. We do host a beginners meeting at Lakewood Park, which is the group I belong to right now. And it gives me the opportunity to be connected with new women on a regular basis. We go through all 12 steps in a month. It's a very intense little thing, but it does get people's feet wet. And I love spending time with newcomers because isn't this true? The first thing that I hear is, yes, but I'm not like you. Really? Tell me how you're not like me. Tell me how you think we're any different. Well, you've got your life together. Okay. Yes, but that's because I stayed sober and was taught by people around me how to do these things. How to hold a job, show up on time, manage money. And when I complicated my life early on in sobriety, how to be a mom to two beautiful children. It was gently suggested that you didn't need to bring your children to every AA meeting, that you might want to enjoy a meeting by yourself. That there was a thing called babysitters, and a lovely lady in my group offered her teenage daughter to help out. You know, so grateful for these words of wisdom I found in these rooms. I love this one story, Diane. She was the 15-year-old. And she says, we moved away from the town just before I entered fourth grade. I was really lonely. I had no friends and I couldn't make any. Then I met kids who smoked, drank, and took drugs. My parents begged, beat me, and argued with me. But what the hell? They were the ones who had me and never wanted me. They were the ones who put me through all the years of misery. Now was the time to pay them back, I decided. Now, I don't think I was that intensely rebellious, but I definitely found those kids that were doing the fun things. And I had a tremendous amount of freedom as a kid. So I read this and I get reminded of where I was and that this is the same girl that I had excerpt that she was just looking for love in all the wrong places, right? But when I came here, I found this real love, this love that went beyond. And the first time I remember feeling it, this love of one alcoholic to the other, was I was sharing early in sobriety. It was only a few months, and I was speaking. I belonged to one of the groups I went to was a clubhouse in Brooklyn, a little clubhouse on the corner, not far from where I lived. And I went up and they asked if I'd speak, and I spoke probably way too long. I can go once I get started. And they held these poor people captive. But I remember taking a deep breath, pausing and looking around the room, and there was probably 10, 12 people in the room. And in spite of the fact that I was going on, sharing nothing but a drunk along, they were listening attentively. They weren't shuffling around. They were all like, they might have their cup of coffee, smoke us another cigarette, but they were all eyes focused on me. And I felt that kind of love, the kind of that we care about you, we're listening to you, we're interested in you. And that's important. You know, and I think it's one of the things, while I love Zoom and our ability to connect and be, you know, to be home in our own space, one of the things about being on Zoom is this, that we do get distracted by what's going on around us. I will do it. I'll put the meeting on my headphones and I'll go off and I'll, you know, get another cup of tea, or, you know, I'll go, you know, check my emails while no one's looking. And I'm, you know, might fuss around, or I might even do a little crafting while I'm sitting there. I would do some of that stuff, you know, at a meeting as well. But on Zoom, you're in this little box and there's this focus, and it kind of distracts, right? Like, you know, we had that at our last quarterly, right? We had, I don't know, over 200 people there, and over 2/3 of the boxes were empty. You know, it didn't mean people weren't listening. You know, I don't know that they weren't, but they weren't, you couldn't see them. And so that's that kind of love, that kind of attention, that kind of connectedness is what we don't get when we just do Zoom meetings. So I'm grateful that my group is meeting live and that we can be connected, and that we can have that FaceTime to see each other. I like the one, there was this, my name is famous. and I can appreciate it. You know, how many of us have said, do you know so-and-so's in recovery? If they haven't broken their anonymity publicly, right? There's a few that we know that have over the years broken their anonymity very, very loudly and very publicly. But we have in our fellowship, you know, there was a singer that came to Vero that I knew from New York, and he was speaking up at the Newport Club, and I went up to hear him, and I was told that, you know, we couldn't go in because it was already a capacity. And I was like, don't you know who I am? And don't you know that I already know him? And don't you know that blah, 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 blah. Like, I put myself in the famous category. Like, I already, you know, but it was, I mean, don't many of us already think that, like, we're famous in our own minds? Like, so when I read this person talking about, you know, don't you know who I think I am, right? Because I have actually used that line. You know, maybe I'm not on TV or haven't, you know, signed any major book deals. The other one was this guy, Phil. He talks about being a low bottom drunk. And in the big book, it talks, you know, it talks a bit about, you know, a low bottom drunk, somebody that's on the streets. When I got sober, I got my sponsor ran a men's rooming house off the Bowery. A lot of people have no idea what that means. They never heard of the Bowery Boys. They never heard of, the large homeless population that's in New York and that whole thing. But those were the guys that I got sober with. I remember them as vividly today as ever. And I identified with all of them. And, you know, I had an apartment in Brooklyn. I paid rent. I think I paid all of like $135 a month for, and that included heat. That was a long time ago. But I felt what they, when they shared, when they talked about their feelings. Yeah. I felt them. I understood like why they would choose not to want to have the burden of what society calls us. And like, just leave me alone. I just want to drink. If I can stem enough money to get a bottle of, you know, cheap wine, then I'm good. You know, I'm good for the night. And in New York, we have those great subway platforms where even in winter, they're still pretty warm. And there's also a very large underground, I don't want to say, it's like a labyrinth. And there's all these little nests of people that set up, you know, it's really an amazing lifestyle. There was a guy, Carl, I met. He came up to Boston and we were kind of, he was still kind of homeless. He just could not, somebody got a trailer for him and tried to get him set up in a little mobile home, and he wasn't having it. He just couldn't deal with being confined. He needed to be out. And even in winter, he'd go find whatever, because he was used to doing whatever he had to do. So this, when you talk about low bottom, I'll tell you, those guys, there's a couple ladies I knew. They were the most prideful people I've ever known. They were like, they had this real arrogance about them. Like, I don't need anybody and no one's going to tell me what I have to do. And, you know, so I got to be friends with a lot of the bottle gang in Brooklyn, and, you know, Danny and Ed. And Ed was, these were all real low bottom guys. They had nothing, you know, day to day, exactly what they had on them was what they had. And Ed was an engineer, which is what I became. I went on and got my degree in engineering. And I'm like, Ed, but you've got all this education, you've got a piece of, no, I don't want anything to do with it. And his story was that he had a business, he had a small consulting business with his partner, and he was married, and his partner and his wife had an affair, and it just broke him, and he just disowned life, and he went on this, he just gave up on everything. But he was a really kind man in so many ways. And he hung with Danny. Danny was the kind of the ringleader of that bottle gang. Danny, these guys, we'd scoop them up every so often and take them down to, you know, a local, one of the local little hospitals that would bring them in and take care of whatever they had going on at the time. And identified. Do you think you're different? Do you think you're different? I didn't think I was different. I identified with them. I felt when they shared their feelings, I felt it. You know, my sponsor said, if you haven't, there's a whole lot of yet to you, baby girl. And if you haven't been there, you might want to go find out what that's like. And so I went to the jails, you know, I started going in, and I've gone to wherever I lived. I went to the local jails or prisons. I went to the detoxes, even though I hadn't been to the detoxes. I went to that spin triad, we called it Long Island. It didn't make sense in my head, but that's what it was in Brooklyn. It was downtown Brooklyn. It was called Long Island, and it was a 5-day spin dry. And You know, I go on Saturday morning and I have to turn off Soul Train. I don't know if any of you remember the dance show that was on Saturday mornings, right? And I turn it down because, you know, they would just wanted to, hey, you can't turn off the music. And I say, well, we're going to be here for about an hour. You know, in those days, we could bring cigarettes in. We could bring a box of donuts in to the jails and to the prisons. They didn't, they weren't restrictive at the time. And I'll tell you, that was a big draw, was having cigarettes. So I'd say, you know, we'll leave some cigarettes for you guys. And they would put up with us for an hour. And, you know, over the course of the couple of years that I was taking that meeting in, I saw the same people in like every couple of weeks, every month. And particularly in the winter, you'd see them back. Like, didn't you go home? Yeah. But I'm back. Right. I didn't feel any different. I didn't feel that I was any different. You know, they say yet, right? You are eligible to. I'm going to go back to the little prompts I had here. I hope that's still showing okay. So do you think you're different? Of course you do, right? I know I did, right? But the pamphlet ends with this wonderful thing. It says, here in AA, we find the shared humanity that enables us to live out our widely differing lives and pursue our separate and individual destinies.